Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about the formation and circulation of knowledge. We're happy to be back on the air after the semester break. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today is Catherine Hales, Director of Graduate Studies in the Program in Literature at Duke University, and someone I regard as the most illuminating public intellectual writing on technology and culture since the publication of her landmark book, How We Became Posthuman, in 1999. She holds advanced degrees in both chemistry and English. Today, she's talking with us by telephone about her latest book, How We Think, Digital Media and Contemporary Technogenesis, published by Chicago University Press. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to have you on the show. There seems to be a growing anxiety in higher education as we begin to come to terms with the implications of technological change, you know, as we move from print to digital media. And this is especially the case, I think, in the humanities, where some believe that machine-assisted practices are soon going to make the old ways of doing things passé. And your book, How We Think, in part, I think, functions as a kind of survey of the growing reach of what has become known as the digital humanities. There are digital humanities programs and centers coming into being at various institutions across the globe. There are massive web-based projects coming into being in almost every discipline and field. Witnessed in our interview last semester with Lisa Cabarica about the Medici Project, which promises to revolutionize early modern studies across the disciplines. And you could say there seems to be what might be called a generation gap just beginning to appear between recently minted scholars who've grown up with digital technologies all their lives and their senior colleagues practicing now a term you also hear by way of contrast, I suppose, the traditional humanities. So my first question is, do you think we are on the verge of sweeping changes in the way we teach and do research in higher education?
Yes, I do think we're on the verge of sweeping changes. One way to measure that is the growth of humanities labs and project-based curriculum. So instead of writing a research paper, for example, in a graduate seminar, scholars now are requiring teamwork, collaboration, and the production of some digitally-based project. So that's one measure of the kind of changes that are going on.
You know, with these changes taking place, do you think conflict is inevitable?
I've thought a lot about this question, and I think that the conflict mode, which is often posed as print versus digital methodologies, is far from inevitable. And I have a new book of collected essays coming out called Comparative Textual Media, A New Paradigm for the Humanities, that makes the argument humanities departments can really benefit from a change of categories and conceptualizations from the existing paradigm to one that takes a media framework as the basis for thinking about research questions. And a media framework would not only include the digital humanities, it would include print-based humanities, it would include manuscript culture, oral culture, scrolls and book rolls in the classical period. So it would be a way to think about the embodiment of the usual foci for humanities departments, arguments, rhetoric, sentences, words, paragraphs, embodied in material instantiation and exploration of the significance of those material instantiations would then become a necessary and natural part of every aspect of the humanities curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
That reduces conflict because it includes print as one of those media modes, along with digital productions, along with manuscript productions, and so forth.
Is this, to some extent, what media studies has been about, a sort of fledgling version of what you're talking about?
Yes, media studies is very much to the point here. I recently returned from a trip to Weimar, Germany, mm-hmm. where they have a quite advanced media studies program. In fact, an entire media studies faculty. And it's interdisciplinary. It includes people in the humanities, but also technical and computer people as well. And it really shows what can be done under this new kind of paradigm.
Our last guest last semester, Tom Warger, he is an academic computing consultant, mentioned he was just at a NIDL conference last year, the National Institute for Technology and Liberal Education, and he heard a talk by Alan Kay, who is the renowned computer science known for the development of object-based computing, WYSIWYG, and graphical interfaces, as well as, you could say, one of the inventors of the computer mouse. And Kay stated that the study of systems should be taught as a basic liberal art, and that the language of systems computing is what should be required of humanities scholars as well as people in the sciences. And do you think this should be a part, then, of this new media-embodied approach to doing liberal arts?
I'm not sure what he meant by systems. There's a large body of research and teaching, in fact, on natural systems, such as ecosystems, but there are also systems that are artificial, or at least that are embodied in artificial media. So I'm thinking here of programs like Artificial Life and Artificial Culture.
Yeah.
And the kind of main point of any kind of study of systems is the complex interconnections and interactions between different agents or components of the system.
Yeah.
This is a way of thinking that's very different from the linearity of discursive models.
Mm-hmm.
So in discursive models, although of course there's been lots of experimental literature, both criticism and literary text, experimenting with ways to complicate that linearity, nevertheless, in discursive systems, you're kind of condemned to what we're doing now, spinning out sentences in linear sequences.
Yes, narrative.
And therefore, the idea that you'd have multiple independent agents interacting is more or less foreign to discursive models.
Mm-hmm.
And in the committee that I'm on here at Duke that was administrating the large grant we got from the Mellon Foundation, I've been making the argument to my colleagues that the humanities should include non-discursive objects as well as discursive objects.
Mm-hmm.
And by non-discursive objects, I would include computer code, but I would also include complex systems. And I think the kind of friction generated between discursive models and those kind of models would be very productive and would really generate a lot of new ideas in the humanities.
So the changes that then we're talking about in higher education and teaching and research, are they farther reaching? You know, there's studies out now that show that young people, undergraduates included, are not as able to perform the kind of deep, close, sustained reading that used to be the staple of a humanities education, and that this isn't a matter of laziness or ethics, but has to do with physical changes that are taking place as the kind of reading that we do online continuously and actually alters the way our brains are wired, so to speak. So my question is, do you think the changes we're talking about in the academy aren't just a matter of evolving teaching and research practices, but have to do with the way technological changes actually are changing the way we think?
I have a chapter in my How We Think book on exactly this question, and I review in there some of the neurological studies that have been done on what I call hyperattention, this new mode of attention that is in contrast to what I call deep attention. I think the evidence is compelling that the technology is changing our modes of attention, and I also think that the younger the cohort, the more apparent this change is. And the young people we now have entering college are maybe the first generation where this change is really noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard just tons of anecdotal evidence from my colleagues to the effect that they can see hyperattention at work in their classrooms, and they're trying to think creatively about how to sustain the tradition of deep attention that's kind of the natural inheritance of the humanities.
Hyperattention isn't something completely new, is it? Because I know from just graduate school, one of the things you have to learn, apart from learning to read deeply and closely, is to read quickly and scan through texts, lots of texts.
Yes, and I think that the fact that modes of scanning and skimming are part of the scholarly research toolbox is very significant. And it suggests that we need to teach our students much more directly how to use these tools that all professional scholars know how to use. But I would also say there's a big difference between scanning and skimming when you have a research question firmly in mind,
mm-hmm.
and idly surfing the internet where you're drawn into a labyrinth of more and more tenuous connections.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a difference between disciplined research methodologies and what many of our students do. We need to convey to them how to practice those skills of skimming and scanning in a rigorous and disciplined way.
The more you scan, the more critical you have to be.
Well, exactly. And you have to be alert for both evidence that's going to support your research question, but as we know, you also need to be extremely alert to evidence that might contradict or complicate it.
So the logical question here is then, is there a way in the way we teach particularly, but new research also, to inform the kind of changes that are going on so that the students that we turn out are able to deal with this complex environment in a more critical and intelligent way than they would otherwise?
Well, absolutely. I think that most good teachers know the place to start is where the students actually are. So that's the first thing to determine. How are your students actually reading? How are they writing their essays? How are they using the internet, social networking tools, and so forth? And once one determines where they actually are, then it's possible to devise all kinds of different strategies to take them where you want them to be.
Another of our recent guests on the program was John Long, a biologist here at Vassar College, who talked about his work with evolving robots, robotic fish that he and his students develop and then evolve to help understand how the first vertebrae evolved in early sea creatures. And one of his students mentioned to him, was an insight, he thought that the robots seemed to be becoming more intelligent as they evolved. You know, they were better at finding food and avoiding predators without anyone's having touched the quote-unquote brain of the robot. That is, the computer that was translating sensory inputs into motor responses. In other words, intelligence in this case was embodied in the physical development of the model itself. And I know you talk about embodiment a lot in your book and also in your earlier work. Can you talk a bit about the notion of embodiment and embodied cognition in particular and what this might mean for us all as we become increasingly enmeshed in this growing digital environment we're all swimming in?
Well, I'm interested to hear you talk about the research in robotics. I've followed for some time the work of Rodney Brooks,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the pioneers in arguing for the importance of embodied cognition. And Brooks pointed out that the research in artificial intelligence in the 1960s and 70s was dominated by the idea that an artificial intelligent agent had to have a map of the world inside its brain.
Mm-hmm.
And Brooks's approach was quite the opposite. He argued that you don't need a conceptual map. In fact, you don't need a view of the world at all. All you need are various modules able to perform limited tasks that can communicate with each other. And his kind of mantra for that is the world is its own best model.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a robot that can sense, for example, how far it is from the perimeter of the room, it can use that information to perform tasks without having any idea of what the actual shape of the room is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this notion of embodied robotics is really a fundamental paradigm shift and also a very fruitful avenue of research. Now, the opposite view is articulated by someone like Marvin Minsky, who's
mm-hmm.
criticized Brooks's work by saying, well, you're just involving your students in electrical engineering and building circuits and putting together robots, whereas if you were just working with a computational AI inside of a computer, you'd get a lot further and you'd solve a lot more problems. But I tend to side with Brooks in this dispute and think that embodied robotics has much more promise than an artificial intelligence modeled on human intelligence.
Mm-hmm. So what about Norbert Wiener's comment that the best model of a cat is a cat? Is this the same?
Yeah, I had never heard that before,
yeah.
But that's very appropriate
yeah.
to the argument here.
Yeah. So just to mention, I noticed looking at the TED Talks that you can access online now that Ray Kurzweil is still going around talking about the, what is it that he calls it?
Singularity.
The singularity, yes, the singularity. And that's a diametrically opposed view to this notion of embodiment, isn't it?
Well, Kurzweil is one of a group of people who self-identify as transhumanists, and the basic tenet of the transhumanist is that human evolution is not finished, and its future, the future of human evolution, is all bound up with technology.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a very ambivalent relationship to transhumanism myself. I think they're correct in saying that the future of human evolution is bound up with technology. But some transhumanists have as part of their idea of what the future will be, uploading human consciousness into a computer.
Yeah, it's very Cartesian, isn't it?
It's very Cartesian, and in my view, it's very naive about the intellectual and cognitive resources that our bodies provide us with and how that would change if such a thing as disembodied intelligence were possible.
So there's a difference between transhuman and what you term post-human.
Well, yes, I do not self-identify as a transhumanist, although I've been accused of that.
Yeah.
But no, I have many, many differences with transhumanist vision.
So can you talk about then what posthumanism is and how it fits in with what we're talking about here?
Well, as I described in my 1999 book, How We Became Posthuman, I see posthumanism really as a rethinking of the assumptions we inherited from the Enlightenment about the autonomy of the individual, the primacy of the rational mind, and so forth. And as I argue in the book, every one of those principles is now contested or outright refuted by contemporary work in robotics, in embodied cognition, in the cognitive unconscious, and a whole bunch of other fields. So it's in that sense that I would talk about posthumanism. Transhumanists say that posthumanism is about conceptual matters and that transhumanism is about actual transformation, physical and technological transformation. But to my mind, you can't separate conceptual transformation so neatly from embodied transformation. They're in a continuous feedback loop with one another.
You don't discount the place of technology, then, in human development.
Well, absolutely not. I'm one of those who argue that the human species has been involved in a co-evolutionary spiral with technology from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of technology here as things like the domestication of fire, the fabrication of simple stone tools, and so forth. So there's strong evidence that things like bipedalism or the opposable thumb co-developed with the use and transport of tools. So the way this works is you fashion a tool, now you want to carry it around from place to place, so the feature of bipedalism is accelerated, but bipedalism furthers the development of other tools and so forth, and that's what I call the technogenetic spiral.
Is the development, then, of the post-human subject, do you think, part of this technogenic evolution, or is it just a different way of thinking?
Well, I don't think that contemporary technogenesis is just a different way of thinking.
No.
I think there are neurological consequences, for example, of intense engagement with digital media. That's not just conceptual thinking, that's actual neurological transformation.
So then, stepping back a bit, do you think the changes in the way we read and the influences that technology is having on us today is part of a kind of evolutionary... somebody's pounding behind me. Yuck.
Well, it is part of an evolutionary spiral, but I should be clear that my argument here is about an evolutionary exchange between the environment and humans. I'm not arguing for genetic evolution.
Oh, I see.
I don't have any evidence for it, but there's a lot of evidence for epigenetic or ontogenic change, that is, change after birth in the neurological functioning of the individual as a result of the environment.
Yeah. Last week, I was with a group of librarians at a meeting, and we were talking about the concept of moving away from the labor-intensive, low-profile work that is so much a part of what we traditionally do into a world where the term good enough is going to be the watchword. And, you know, it does seem to me as though technology is pressing us into faster and faster transactions, where everything is a matter of point and time of need and instant gratification. Certainly, in my, you know, my relationship as a librarian with students, that seems very much the case. We seem to need to attend to many things at once, but no one thing for more than a few minutes. So is there a point where the feedback loops that drive this rate of technological change are going to increase to a point, you know, where they become short circuits? Or will the rate of change stabilize, do you think?
Well, that's a complex question, and my intuition about it is that it's very much going to depend on what context one is talking about. To see the trajectory good enough, I think all we have to do is look at the documentation on software. It used to be that you would get a manual when you bought a piece of software, and now, of course, those days are long gone. You get a list of known problems and fixes that you can patch into your software and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's always the beta version you're working with, it seems.
Yeah, and you're working with, in fact, the beta version. Yeah. That's exactly right. So one understands why that happens, because the cycle of innovation is faster and faster, and there's no time to create this extensive documentation, and in any event, as soon as it was created, it's going to be out of date. So why bother in the first place? And there are a lot of places where you could justify a good enough ethic of work. I also think there are places where it has really deleterious effects. So let me talk about my own field of endeavor, writing scholarly books.
Sure.
It used to be that people would take maybe a lifetime to write a scholarly book, and that book would be the culmination of years of research and thinking. Now, younger scholars don't have that luxury. They have to produce a book before tenure and possibly, depending on their institution, two books before tenure. And so you're beginning to see a lot of very thin books. I don't just mean thin in volume, although many of them are thin in volume. I mean very thin in conception, that they have maybe one idea, maybe two ideas at most, and they lay these out in the introduction, and then they rehearse them through four or five chapters in a very repetitious way. So if you read the introduction, you've sort of got the whole of the book. I'm very much opposed to that. I understand why especially younger, untenured scholars feel the need to do that, but it seems to me we don't need more scholarship, we need better scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
And in that instance, good enough is not good enough. It has to be rigorous, it has to be deeply thought through, it has to be profound in its implications. And if we lose that, I think the whole field of scholarship will be impoverished as a result. One of the books I admire is Ian Balcom's Specters of the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking with Ian about that book and asked him how long it took him to write it. And he said, 5 or 6 years. And I said, well, what took so long? And he said, well, it took me that long to understand what the archival material was implying. He said, I just kept going over and over it, and each time I went over it, I could see more in it. Well, that's a book that's already revolutionized how people have thought about the slave trade and its relation to capital. And my sense is it's going to endure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's books like that that we need more of, not more superficial, thin books.
You mentioned the technological unconscious a moment ago. Can you talk about the notion of consciousness in light of what we're learning about our relationship with our tools?
The phrase, the technological unconscious, comes from the British geographer Nigel Thrift. And what he means by that is the way in which our deeply layered and technologically built environments affect us on levels way below consciousness, affect our sense of possibilities, of our position in the world, and so forth. So a good example of that might be something like GPS technology and how that has affected our sense of location, movement, and navigation. And he calls it the technological unconscious because he wants to emphasize that these effects saturate our awareness on levels way below what we can access consciously. Mm-hmm. And we now know through recent work in neuroscience and cognitive psychology that there is something that the cognitive psychologists call the cognitive unconscious. And the cognitive unconscious is not the Freudian unconscious that relies on suppression and repression, but rather a kind of broad, continuous scanning of the environment enriched with information that will never make it into conscious awareness. So we can think about this broad scanning of the environment like a very diffuse light playing over everything. Mm-hmm. What gets into consciousness is the little pinpoint of a searchlight, but our awareness goes much, much beyond that. And so it's through something like the cognitive unconscious that our built environment affects our behaviors, our goals, our sense of ourselves in relation to the environment, and all of that is kind of encapsulated in this phrase, the technological unconscious.
So looking at things from a post-human perspective, does machine reading fit in here, I guess, is the question, with this notion of technological unconsciousness?
Well, the phrase machine reading comes out of the digital humanities, and it's a way to take texts that either were born digital or have been scanned and now are in digital form, and asking some research questions of those texts. And the advantage here is that machine reading can read large corpora of thousands of novels, for example, on a scale that simply is not possible for human reading. I think there are a lot of misconceptions about machine reading. That machine reading, I heard Stanley Fish recently argued, is devoid of interpretive value.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's completely wrong, because in order to write the software, you have to have very specific research questions in mind. And then you fashion software to be able to ask those research questions. But the interpretive aspect doesn't end there. You get, let's say, a word frequency table, but what that table means then is a matter of human interpretation. So there's always a back and forth between what machine cognition can do and what human interpretive cognition can do.
Machine reading, I imagine, generally is applied, as you say, to large bodies of data in databases. And this kind of reading is quite different in and of itself to that you have in the traditional humanities that make up so much of the traditional humanities. So, you know, the question is, are databases and narrative scholarship sort of natural enemies? Are these two kinds of reading?
Well, the phrase database and narrative are natural enemies comes, of course, from Lev Manovich's famous anecdote in The Language of New Media. And in How We Think, I try to refine some of Manovich's claims, but I do think there are, well, my argument is that narrative and database are natural symbionts rather than natural enemies. There are distinctive modes for each of those. Databases tend to operate on a spatial logic, whereas narrative tends to operate on a temporal logic. And the interaction between narrative and database, therefore, can be seen in part as an interaction between a spatial logic and a temporal logic. And there are many contemporary literary works that show these two logics in deep interaction. So one of the ones I discuss in How We Think is Mark Danielewski's wonderful epic poem come novel called Only Revolution.
Something many theorists of the arts over the years, and of language, the language arts in particular, seem to agree on is that the humanities offer a way of thinking that allows us to keep one foot in the transcendent, which is something that data-driven practices, you know, such as collecting, organizing, and analyzing data, don't seem amenable to doing. You know, databases, in other words, tend in and of themselves to be totalizing. So, you know, the question is, how do you fit this kind of practice into the humanities without losing this resistance to closure and containment? In other words, how do databases, for instance, deal with the imaginary?
Well, one way to think about the transcendent in literary terms is as that which eludes explicit articulation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are all manner of ways in which literary texts have approached that problem. How do you say what inherently resists you being able to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And that very much is not only a literary tradition, but I would say a humanities tradition as well. One of the people that's done some research on this question is Alan Liu,
mm-hmm.
who talks both about painting, Turner's paintings, for example, and other instances where you get a kind of what he calls a data pour, that is a break in the texture of the canvas where the image suddenly becomes incandescent and unperceivable as such. It's
mm-hmm.
just a blaze of light. And his argument is that that point represents the point at which the data becomes so intense it can no longer be represented.
Oh, interesting.
That's a really interesting interpretation.
Yeah, it is,
because
yeah.
it connects the transcendence not to a spirituality, for example, but to a blazing excess of information.
Mm-hmm.
And once you begin to think about it in those terms, you can see that databases are places where data can be explicitly articulated, but the data, like spirituality in general, has the capacity to suddenly become so excessive, so unmanageable, so
mm-hmm.
unfathomable, that it then eludes its container, or it bursts out of its container.
Yeah, it sounds like a library to me, you know, from a librarian's perspective. Yeah.
The container, in this case, being a database.
Yeah.
So what's different in Liu's interpretation, I think, is to see these not as mutually exclusive opposites. You have transcendence on the one hand and you have databases on the other, but rather as a kind of continuum in which data can become the essence of a transcendent experience. You get that in literary texts like Tennyson's The Crying of Lot 49.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what that novel is moving toward, the moment at which data becomes so overwhelming that it becomes a different kind of experience
yeah.
altogether.
As a librarian, I've often thought of the Academy as a kind of reification of a cognitive model that we inherit from Aristotle. And in this model, the library functions as a faculty of memory, which means as a kind of a hard disk where records are kept for access by the other faculties, which are then imagination and reason, according to the Aristotelian model, or the screen and the processor, you know, if we're using a computer model. And traditionally, the work of this cognitive machine has been divided up so that librarians managed memory and faculty and students provided imagination and reason through discourse in the classroom and elsewhere, and also in new publications, which then are themselves added into the memory. So my question is, as a librarian, with the advent of digital humanities, do we need to find new roles for ourselves in the collaborative work that this kind of labor requires? Not that it always hasn't been research and even teaching collaborative in some way. It's just that the division of labor has been traditionally more clear.
Well, one of the theorists who's written a lot about the importance of memory is Bernard Stiegler in his book Time and Technics 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And Stiegler argues for the importance of what he calls tertiary retention.
Mm-hmm.
So primary retention are your own experiences. Secondary retention is the memory of your experiences
mm-hmm.
that you have. Tertiary retention is the memory of experiences you never had.
Uh-huh.
And in order to have tertiary retention, you need to have some kind of storage medium,
mm-hmm.
like books, for example, or libraries as another example. But I think that there is an unrecognized print-centric bias in this way of thinking, and that is to think of media primarily as a storage mechanism.
Yeah.
It's not just a matter of storage, it's also a matter of organization.
Yes, yeah, you can't have one without the other.
Yeah, which of course is primary for libraries. But in digital media, there's a shift, I would argue here,
mm-hmm.
from memory being primary to action. So software doesn't just remember things, it has the power of action and increasingly autonomous action. And so there's a question of agency here that isn't really captured by the notion of memory storage or even memory organization. So to begin to think of repositories as actors,
mm-hmm.
not just passive containers that we stuff things into in various organizational schemes. And once we begin to think about digital media as intimately involved with action, not just memory,
mm-hmm.
we then have a way to begin to think about digital media as the purveyors of evolutionary dynamic and the idea of a self-organizing, self-learning algorithm is kind of the epitome of this joining of autonomous action with an evolutionary dynamic. And there are now whole areas of the culture, for example, high-speed trading in finance capital, that are dominated by self-learning, self-evolving algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need to rethink the role that our libraries play in our culture to emphasize more the possibilities of agency and not just organization and story.
Interesting. The sentence always starts out that libraries aren't just warehouses, and then that, you know, we shouldn't be thinking of ourselves just holders of information, but we should be thinking about how that information might be communicated to the benefit of the cultivation of knowledge generally, and that librarians should think of themselves more like investment bankers. That's not quite what you're saying there, is it?
Well, I have a big complaint against investment
bankers. Investment bankers, right.
So
bankers is not...
Libraries to be like investment
bankers. No, bankers is probably not the, not the role model we want right now.
I would be glad to have libraries think about themselves as catalytic evolutionary agents of change.
And to do that, then, librarians, I would think, then have to become more involved in projects with faculty. There has to be more collaboration, more understanding, I think, then.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that the cutting edge of digital humanities knows that very well.
Yeah.
And a lot of big data projects, for example, demand collaboration between librarians, faculty, people in information science, and so forth. And I think this is absolutely the way to go.
So one last question, and I generally ask this question of all my guests, since our program is in part about libraries and the research process. Can you talk about how you conducted research for How We Think, which is, as I read it, it's full of theory, you know, an account of theory in various areas, but it's also a survey of what's going on out there, it seems to me, in the digital humanities at the moment.
Well, different people work different ways, of course, but in my way of working, I usually start with a proposition that I feel very ambivalent about.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of my post-human book, that was the proposition that we have become post-human.
Yeah.
For the How We Think book, it was the proposition that humans are not the sole determiners of their destiny, but technology has a strong role to play as well.
Mm-hmm.
And especially aspects that we've just talked about, like the faster and faster cycles of innovation, the move toward hyper-attention, and so forth. So it was those kinds of questions that I wanted to raise, and the strategy of the book was to examine these questions through different lenses.
Mm-hmm.
So one of those lenses was kind of on institutional change we see with the advent of the digital humanities. But another lens was this whole question of attention and the work that's been done on that. And then ever since the post-human book, I've also kind of made a private, desirable aspect of my research, having at least one chapter that involves extensive archival work.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the How We Think book, that chapter was the chapter on telegraph code book.
Yeah, very interesting chapter on the history of the telegraph code book.
And as you no doubt know, when you get involved with archival work in a deep way, it's just a mass of chaotic, almost unmanageable information. And so that chapter took a tremendous amount of work. I probably spent far more time on that chapter than I did any of the other chapters.
Yeah.
I also like to include some actual literary texts.
Yes, you do close readings. You did in both the Posthumanism book and How We Think.
Yeah, and that's important to me, to show how literary texts interact with these other lenses that,
mm-hmm.
that we can put on. So that's the way that the book was structured, and like all of my books, this book took a fairly long time to write, but given my scholarly commitments, I'm committed to long, difficult books.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if it takes 5 years, it takes 5 years. Yeah. You know, it takes what it takes.
So I want to thank you, Catherine, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, How We Think, Digital Media and Contemporary Technogenesis, published by Chicago University Press.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, I have very much. I'm very grateful.